Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Can we do some shout-outs?
I'll allow it. I'm just kidding. It's our podcast. We can do whatever we want.
Yeah, but also, I think it's so important to recognize the people who week after week tune into us.
I listen to us every week.
You don't count. You have to, because check to see how many mistakes I made editing.
That's true. Very, very true.
Well, there are some people that are absolute loyal followers, listen every week, and we cannot thank them enough. Katie Drew, 4708 on YouTube.
Yes.
Assume your name's Katie Drew. We've been calling you Katie Drew around here, but thank you, Katie, so much. Seriously. Shannon Bradley Byers.
Shannon, thank you.
Who's going to be a guest, right? Kayla G.
And she's on her boss, so she has to listen, but she does
doesn't
listen.
Doesn't matter.
And so does Maymay, her dog. So that, thanks, Maymay.
That really doesn't count because she can't click on anything without thumbs. So
damn, that's true.
Jenny M., who's a friend of mine.
Oh, thanks, Jenny.
And Cassandra C., who we love.
Yay, Cassandra. Thank you so much for listening. You're the best.
Thank you, guys. What is up, crime crew? Welcome back to Murder Unscripted, episode 55, to be exact, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, along with my bestie, Melissa Spivey.
Hey, yo, 55 episodes? That's wild.
And we are approaching, I dare I say 100?
Like, don't
I think we're now on the downside of the hill toward 100, and we got something big planned that I'm working on today, actually.
I know, you had a busy day.
I did, sure did, but you're not going to know. Even you know a little bit, you don't even know everything.
Yeah, I don't even know, guys, so don't feel bad. He just does whatever he wants. You just gotta let him go sometimes.
I'm a loose cannon, Melissa.
You're something.
Free spirit. Well, we are in week two of our block called Hot Summer Cold Cases. And last week you told us, my God, the incredibly sad story of Sarah Yarbrough. I was not ready for that.
Yeah, I really wasn't either. And I'm the one who wrote it. But it was a rough case. But it was solved thanks to genetic genealogy, not familial DNA. And if you aren't sure of the difference, go back to last week and I got you.
Yeah, you did a great job explaining that.
Thank you. I was like, how would I understand it? How can I dumb it down for myself?
Okay, a pop-up book.
That's what I needed, seriously.
Pictures.
Also, I'm still swooning over the forensic genealogist / angel from our episode last week, Colleen M. Fitzpatrick.
You can't, you're allowed to, is it like girl swoon? Because she's not like, well, I think Ken Brennan.
Oh, I do swoon over him. No, I'm like obsessed with Colleen. She's so cool.
But that's not swoon. That's just an obsession, which is okay. Cause she deserves, I'll tell you what, if you should be obsessed with somebody, what a role model. I mean, that woman exactly. Is so, she has degrees coming out her ears and she's like, oh, should I work for NASA today? Or should I solve crimes with a new forensic test? Like she's insane.
I think we should try to get her on.
We can. I agree with that. I think she'd be really insightful.
All right. That's our next big thing. Put it on the to-do list. Cause if we don't, we'll forget.
We know Ken ain't calling us.
Awkward.
We were rejected.
Womp womp.
Staunchly. It was a hard rejection.
They don't like us. After all the nice things I said.
Take them all back. Put a shirt on, Brennan.
Oh, no, take it off. It's fine. I forgive you.
You're so shallow. Well, before we get started today, Melissa, I just want to remind everybody to, if you guys like what you're hearing from Murder Unscripted, give us a like, a subscribe, a follow. Goes a long, long way to helping us build this brand and continue to get the word out about these stories. So it doesn't take more than a second, and it goes a long way on our end.
Yeah, be cool. Do it. Peer pressure.
Everybody's doing it.
Yeah, all the cool kids. Well, moving on to today's case, which, by the way, was put together by our very lovely Sue Van Valkenburg Grice. She's amazing and a huge help. Because I am knee deep in research for July, so I really needed help, or we would not have an episode today.
What would we be without this team? My God.
I have no idea. I'd be crying in a corner more than I usually
more
am.
More than usual.
Anyway, all right, today we are going way, way back to 1943, the year you were born.
That's nice.
And I know that not everyone loves like older cases, but this case happens actually in like the 70s, and then solving it doesn't happen until 2022. So
then why are we going back to 1943?
Because I got to start the story somewhere.
All right.
So stick with me for a couple of minutes. It's worth it, I promise. So it's 1943, and a gentleman named Merrill Anderson, who goes by Andy, comes of age, and like millions of other young men, with one signature, he volunteers his life for the war efforts, and he joins the United States Navy. So Andy becomes a boiler man, and he was assigned to a supply ship, the USS Cygnus, in the Pacific Theater.
Wow.
So during this time, Andy's sweetheart, Thelma, I love that name. That was my grandma's name.
It's a very old name.
Her name was actually Thelma Louise, like way before the movie came out. I know, wild.
That is wild.
Anyway, Andy's sweetheart was named Thelma, and she was working at a Chevy auto plant that had been converted to like support the war effort.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So the two got married when Andy was home on leave, and then Thelma, you know, had to wait anxiously for her husband to come home, and that he did, thankfully. He returned home with an honorable discharge at the end of the war, and he would actually spend the rest of his life being a dedicated Chevy man because of his love for Thelma, which I thought was so sweet.
That is sweet. I don't know. There's nobody in the military in my family, so I don't know what it's like to live that military life where you only see your loved one every couple months or years sometimes.
Yeah, I imagine that would be really difficult.
Yeah.
Well, these two lovebirds really put the boom in Baby Boomer. As they would build their life and family on deep faith, they went on to have 10 children.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
A lot of kids.
Mike, Carol, Gail, Nancy, Mary, Betty, Jim, Jack, Janet, and Bill.
Wow.
Which personally to me sounds like a damn nightmare, but...
Could you imagine her yelling at one of the kids? The name's like, Jim, Harry, Bill, like, to figure out just because they're all in her head.
Exactly. You would never be able to get to the right kid. Well, anyway, Andy was able to use his military trade to settle his family in Bay City, Michigan, with a very well-paying job at one of the industrial factories. And he worked swing shifts with like weekly rotation, and he would pick up extra shifts whenever they offered, of course, because you got 10 kids. So you have to pick up all the shifts.
Every shift. I'll take them all.
Exactly. Well, sadly, it was on one of those pickup shifts that Andy was critically injured in an accident.
Oh, no.
It was actually like more like an explosion.
Oh, man. At the factory.
Yeah.
Wow.
So part of the system that he was like working around had been built in the 1920s. And now after like 40 some odd years, the pressure on the system, like it just ended in this catastrophic failure. The boiler explosion occurred 2 weeks after Christmas Eve. So we're like,
what a way to start the year. God.
Right? So we're 2 weeks out of Christmas. This was Andy's second shift of the week. He was 2 hours into his workday and 2 minutes after his coffee break. In spite of 90% of his body being covered in third-degree burns, he was able to make it to the control panel shutoff, and he was able to save the rest of the factory and the lives of everyone else in that building.
People were built different back then.
Oh my God, right? Like, he saved so many lives that day.
Incredible.
So his oldest son, Mike, who was 18 at the time, he was studying at seminary school. He was summoned to the hospital and like they just told him his dad was in an accident. So he's expecting to walk in and just see his dad with like a broken arm or something like that. The complete shock on his face at seeing his barely recognizable dad. Like,
can you imagine, especially if you're not told, if that sprung on you? Holy cow.
I can't even imagine like to walk into that. And he told his dad just like how bad the situation was because the doctors weren't telling him anything at the time. So 2 weeks and 2 days later, Andy succumbed to his injuries in what would be just the first of many tragedies for the Anderson family.
Some families, we've talked about this before, just have black clouds that hang over them. And I feel like in true crime, when we'll do the story, we're calling a family to find out about the loved one of theirs that made the headlines, you know?
Yeah.
It'll snowball. They'll be like, and right after that happened, my mom passed away of a broken heart. And then my dad, because my mom died. So it's like this, or somebody gets a terminal illness. It's like, but it always seems to happen to the same families. And you wonder what's in the water, or just, man, bad luck. Luck of the draw.
So Thelma's trying to process the accident and grieve the love of her life, but she still has 10 kids to hold it together for.
You don't have time to take a shower without kids being around, let alone.
It's true.
Something this magnitude. I can't even imagine.
I think it gives you a reason to get up in the morning, though, because you know you have to survive for the kids. So, like, you can't let your grief and, like, being so upset overwhelm you because, like, you're responsible for so many others. So, like, in a way, it's almost good that she had all those kids.
It's true. It doesn't make it any easier, though.
No. So in 1970, Thelma took a trip to Colorado to visit Mike, he was the oldest, as he was continuing his education there. And while she's on this trip, she just like falls in love with the mountains and the sunshine. She just loved it. So she ends her like vacation, she comes home to Michigan, and she's got like this spark in her. Like, it was like Colorado was like what she needed to breathe life into her, for lack of like a better phrase.
I had a similar experience there so I've been to Colorado twice now, and both times you look around and there is nowhere you can look that doesn't have this beautiful mountain range, these tall trees. I mean, it's a place that if I didn't have ties to the area, if I didn't have family here, if I had my free will, I would be living in Colorado right now. It is
really
a majestic place.
Well, Thelma felt the same way. She was all about it. So she got home and she told the rest of the kids that at the end of the school year, they were picking up and moving to Colorado. So now I'm going to switch gears. I'm going to tell you about Nancy. She's sibling number 4 out of 10.
Okay.
And I feel like with big families, like, you always hear stories about like there's a bossy sibling, there's the jokester sibling. Like, she was just very outgoing and she had a really cool confidence about herself, which reminded me of Nicole Brown Simpson. But Nancy, she also had a little bit of like a rebelliousness and she had a big imagination. One random day, she told like all of her friends and everyone at school that it was her birthday and they were invited to her birthday party. Spoiler alert, it was not her birthday.
It was not her birthday.
So she comes home and she tells Thelma what's going on. And like, Thelma was like, you know what? Let's go with it. So she decided that instead of like being pissed off about it or like upset, she went to the store, she bought a bunch of hot dogs and a cake and ice cream and pulled off a not your birthday party.
That's amazing. That they celebrated her birthday.
It's like your very merry unbirthday, like from Alice in Wonderland.
I pull that at Applebee's, but it's usually just to get like a free peach cobbler or something.
Do they sing to you?
Oh, with vigor.
Oh, yeah. That's awful. That's the worst. Well, I mentioned earlier that the Anderson family was very, you know, very faithful, and they were brought up in kind of a more conservative house. So by the time Nancy was in 10th grade, and we're talking like 1968-ish, mini skirts were like all the rage in fashion. I kept thinking of Nancy Sinatra.
Yeah.
But this Nancy, she wasn't really allowed to wear the mini skirts. So she would ride the bus. And so she would get on the bus with her sister, Gail. Nancy would pull out a needle and thread and bring the hem of her skirt up to a trendier length, and she would put makeup on. And then on the way home from school, she would reverse the process and like take the hem out, and then she'd take her makeup off, and her mom would never be the wiser. And like,
I love this girl with all my heart.
Isn't she amazing?
Yes, 100%.
And Gail remembers just watching Nancy doing this. And frankly, she was just fascinated by the process.
She's awesome.
Isn't she? Well, Gail never told on Nancy, and Nancy's small rebellion was never talked about between them. It was just one of those like sisterly confidences that was always kept like quiet between the two of them.
Love it.
So in early summer of 1970, Nancy graduated from high school. And with her mom's big move to Colorado, like right on the horizon, Nancy wasn't sure what she wanted to do because she knew like the family was going to go to Colorado. So she had to kind of come up with a plan. And she had originally decided she was going to join the Air Force after graduation. But the Vietnam War was going on at the time. And she decided that might not be the adventure that was right for her. So she did decide to join the family in Colorado.
I feel like this move to Colorado would have been good for the entire family because of what happened to their dad in the explosion. Even though we're not talking about murder or true crime at this point, just an accident, it still probably helped them to get away from kind of ground zero.
Yeah, and almost like get a fresh start with things and maybe even go somewhere where people don't know your story. And
exactly.
You don't get that look of pity from the man at the grocery store. You know, like sometimes that can be the hardest part, I think. So,
because you just want to feel normal again. And the best way is to surround yourself with people who aren't going to harp on the bad stuff you're trying to forget.
Exactly. So Thelma ended up making the right decision by moving her family. Like it was a good move. The family really needed it. And everyone was settling into their new town. The younger kids were getting ready for the new school year and making new friends. So Nancy started to work at a few different local places to save up money. And while she had decided against going to the Air Force, her best friend had actually joined, and the two would write each other like letters all the time. Mm-hmm. So Nancy knew that she was destined for like an adventure, but she just wasn't really sure what it was going to be. So at the local fair, just for fun, Nancy stopped to see the fortune teller that was there. And this is so creepy, but Nancy was told, "You are not long for this world." And,
oh man, that's haunting.
"Your life will be cut short and you won't live beyond your teenage years."
First of all, what kind of fortune teller is that tells you you're going to die?
Feel like a real good psychic isn't like, they don't tell you that stuff.
No, that I would sugarcoat that. Because you want them to come back.
Right?
And you also don't want to screw them up in the head. Like I wouldn't be able to sleep ever again.
I had a psychic once tell me not to get on the airplane the night before I was supposed to fly to Vegas.
But it's Vegas, so you probably went anyway.
Of course I went. So as Nancy was figuring out like where she was going to set off for her life adventures, she remembered her father had been in Hawaii during his World War II days. And that was pretty much it for Nancy. She was like, shit, I'm going to Hawaii. And she was going to see what the world had to offer her.
I like the fact that this girl has no reservations. Like she has kind of a Nike just do it attitude.
I know, right? She did have $2,000 that her mom had set aside for her. It was like her portion of the insurance money from her dad's death.
In 1971, $2,000 will get you a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. And whatever money she had saved. So she had her money on top of the $2,000. So after arriving in Hawaii, the next day she prepaid for an apartment she had found in the newspaper, and she went out to get a job at McDonald's. And she like set up a budget for the new life she was starting. She was going to make it work, like come hell or high water.
Good for her. This is her just taking a chance. Like, you know what? If I have to work at McDonald's to make this dream a reality, then I'll work at McDonald's. Like she was just out for whatever it took to make this life what she wanted it to be.
So 2 months and 2 days later, Nancy took a flight back to Colorado in order to spend Christmas with her family. And she was really excited to go home and see everyone.
I'll bet.
And like her first night home, she and one of her younger sisters, Mary, they were sharing a room and they just like stayed up almost the whole night talking. And, you know, Nancy got to tell her everything about Hawaii and like this great life she's living. And she shared that her plan was to go back to Hawaii after the holidays, work more and save up, because like she knew that Hawaii was just a temporary stop in like her grand adventure. And she was actually thinking about settling in the Denver area. And I think that at that point, Nancy was really longing for someone like she had a meaningful connection with, because I can't imagine constantly being surrounded like with 9 other siblings and then going totally out on your own. Like, I think that maybe she was a little bit lonely and missed the true companionship of people who know and love her. This is the part that stinks. Like, I wish that, because we just, there's so many questions still, but it's like, I wish Nancy had been known to keep a journal, because it sounds like she was keeping some things about Hawaii to herself. No. During that late night chat she was having with her sister, Mary, as they were drifting to sleep, Nancy said to Mary, "If something ever happens to me, remember this name."
Whoa, cue the crow.
Uh-huh.
Wow, that's foreshadowing. But I wonder, was she like sleep talking? Or was, did she just not finish her sentence?
Well, she said the name. Mary remembered her saying the name, but no matter how hard she tried, she still cannot remember the name that Nancy told her that night.
It may have been, you know, those dreamlike states could have been.
Yes. Where you're not fully asleep, not fully awake. Yeah. And like, unfortunately, we don't really know about anything about her relationships while she was out there or really what was going on, because it's Christmas time and all these people are in the house. So no one really pressed her for more information. Like, they could kind of tell something was maybe bothering her, but, you know, they just never got a chance to ask. I will say, for Christmas that year, Nancy gave her family like the most thoughtful gift since. So they're still working on like the new house that they had moved to Colorado in. So since they're still working on the new house, they don't have like everything hung up, whatever. Nancy had an individual portrait photo of her parents and then like all the graduation photos of the older siblings and the most recent school photos of the younger siblings. She got all of that framed so they could be like hung on the one wall and create like a family gallery photo wall. And her brother Jack really emphasized how much Nancy put, like how much care and thought and love that she put into framing everyone's photos and hanging them with precision, like in birth order. And
wish I could get away with getting my family a framed photo for Christmas. Save about $2,000.
Yeah, but to be fair, she did get how many pictures? 9 kids and her parents and her. That adds up.
I forgot about how many siblings there were.
Exactly. So by the time Nancy's Christmas vacation came to an end, you know, she's getting ready to return to Hawaii, and she told her sister, "I don't want to go back."
Something was going on.
Yeah. Well, her sister regrets to this day that, you know, she didn't ask Nancy any follow-up questions. She was kind of more of like a practical mindset, like, well, all your stuff's there. Like, you got to go back and at least get your stuff.
Yeah.
And so on January 2nd, 1972, Nancy said goodbye to her family and she returned to Hawaii.
I don't know where this story's going, but I have a feeling she may have actually said goodbye to her family, which is sad to think about.
Well, this next part is like one of those crazy and unexplainable things, like how you always kind of hear with twins, like they know if the other one's like hurting, even if they're apart kind of thing.
Yeah.
So on Friday, January 7th, Nancy's back in Hawaii and her family is 4,000 miles away in Colorado. And, you know, the holidays are over. Everyone's getting back into the normal routine of things. And which, by the way, the Anderson siblings, when they talk about each other, they always reference each other's birth number. So that's what I'm going to do. So we have Jack number 7. No, I'm sorry. Jim, number 7, Jack, number 8, and Bill, number 10. So we have like 7, prisoners. 8, and 10. So the three brothers and some of their friends were hanging out in the basement, and they're just playing pool. And the pool table's a little close to the wall that Nancy had just hung all those family photos on 2 weeks earlier. Well, one of the friends had to tilt the pool stick up at like a weird angle to try to avoid hitting the wall to take his shot. Well, he didn't do it right. And with a little like thud, the butt of the stick hits the wall. So Thelma is also in the basement at this time, but she was sitting in a chair kind of like on the other side of the basement. And her back was to the boys playing pool because she was watching. She was facing the TV and she was actually looking down because she was sewing something at the time.
Okay.
So when that pool stick hit the wall, the next thing you heard was crashing glass and Thelma shouting, "Nancy."
Oh, my God.
And the three brothers felt this weird feeling wash over them. And like when everyone turned towards the wall, Nancy's photo, the only picture out of the 12 pictures hanging on the wall, had come crashing to the ground.
Not only is that terribly ominous for Nancy, but also she could have maybe been yelling Nancy because Nancy got the that could have been a coincidence, that part.
Yes.
I'm not convinced that was probably Nancy because Nancy just got you those great pictures and framed them. So that would have been the first thought too. Nancy, like Nancy's pictures.
Well, and they said it was like her photo had literally jumped off the wall because it didn't touch any of the other photos like below it. Like it didn't knock anybody else down. It was just her picture like jumped off.
Wow.
There's a lot of very eerie things in the story. Like everything seems to happen around the number 2, if you haven't noticed so far. And then things like this happen and the fortune teller, like it's very eerie.
Mm.
The next day was Saturday, January 8th, and the Anderson family, they went to church, and on the way home, they stopped for ice cream. And it was kind of like a little like homage to their dad, because that was the 6th anniversary of the explosion at the factory.
Oh, gotcha.
So when they returned home, Mike, number 1, was waiting for his family, and this poor guy, he's 24 years old at this time, for the second time in his life, he had the burden of telling his mom like the worst news ever. Nancy had been found in her room dead and suffering from 63 stab wounds.
What? I have so many questions. Like, how did he find out? I wonder.
I have no idea.
All of that stuff that she was talking about, not wanting to go back to Hawaii. Now it's becoming very clear why.
Yeah. Isn't that wild? Like,
man.
So I'm going to tell you what we do know. I'll run through the timeline of like what we know about the day that Nancy was killed. And honestly, there isn't like a massive amount to cover, which is part of why her case ended up becoming a cold case. And that was at no fault of the police department or anything like that. They kicked ass with this case. They did a really good job tracking down as many leads as possible, preserving evidence, and they kept really detailed notes on the entire investigation and like everyone they interviewed and polygraphed and all that.
That's good to hear, because so often we hear about cold cases and the reason they're cold is because there were some big time screw ups on the front end. So yes. It's really nice to hear that wasn't the case, that it was just a really difficult case to solve.
All right. So here's the timeline of the day that she was killed. So Nancy and her roommate, Jody Spooner, lived in the Coral Terrace Apartments on Aloha Drive, which sounds like beautiful.
Sounds gorgeous, yeah.
In Honolulu. And this was like a pretty secure apartment building because guests had to be like buzzed in by the tenant. So it wasn't like anyone couldn't just walk wherever they wanted.
Yeah.
Like, and keep in mind, Jody and Nancy weren't like super close. Their relationship was friendly and like chill, but Nancy had met her, she answered an ad in the newspaper, so like for a roommate, and she'd only been living there for like 2.5 months.
Yeah, so they can really develop that like unbreakable bond that some people get when they live together. They just...
Right. So like they're cool, they get along, yeah. So Jody told police on Friday, January 7th, she left the apartment at noon to go do some shopping. She got back to the apartment. It was about 2:30 p.m. And when she returned home, Nancy had two young men in the apartment. These guys were cutlery salesmen. Remember when people used to walk around selling knives?
Door to door knife, Cutco. They cut through a piece of marble. It's still sharp.
Probably, yeah. So at about 3 p.m., you know, they were done their little spiel and Nancy wasn't buying anything. So she escorted them like out of the apartment and walked them. She actually walked them all the way out to the street. So like they were out, you know, they couldn't get back in unless they were buzzed in, whatever. So when Nancy comes back to the apartment, she and Jody chatted and like caught up just on the day for about 10 minutes. And then Jody was like, I'm super tired. I'm going to go lay down for a while. So she goes to her room and takes a nap. When Jody wakes up from her nap, she can hear water running from Nancy's bathroom. And it seems to be running for a while, but she's just kind of like, maybe she's in the shower or whatever. Well, finally, at 5:15, she went to see what's going on, only to find Nancy in what Jody initially assumed was a suicide, and she ran to the phone and called for help. She only thought it was a suicide because she didn't think who else could have been in the apartment. She thought it was just them.
Yeah, while she was taking a nap. This is
exactly.
Like, there's a lot of questions here.
So many questions. So police arrived by about 6 p.m., and they, like, really went hard on investigating. They examined everything from top to bottom. They realized there was no indication of forced entry, and like there was no damage to anything or like any messes anywhere except for Nancy's room. Her room had two twin beds in it. So one bed was like perfectly neatly made up. Nope, you know, just like it had been.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was all disheveled and like the sheets were just soaked with blood. And Nancy's laying on the floor next to that twin bed. And like she's laying on her back with her eyes open. And her shirt was partially ripped, but otherwise she was fully clothed. So police didn't think this was sexually motivated.
I'm wondering what motivated this at all. Like this is a, so to me, the initial impression that I got is that Jody's hiding something. Because how do you sleep unless she's on Ambien?
No, we'll get there. We'll get there about how okay. She didn't notice. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But so they don't think it's actually motivated, but they do. They're like, this is an incredibly violent crime scene. So as the police are looking around, they find two bloody towels inside the apartment. And as they searched around the apartment complex, they found another huge piece of evidence, which was a blue towel soaked in blood.
Weird.
Which like led investigators believe the killer probably cut himself or herself at some point during the attack against Nancy, probably grabbed the towel and like ran out.
Yeah.
So once a medical examiner had a chance to look at Nancy's body, they documented 63 puncture wounds made with like, that's wild, 63.
That's personal.
So they were made with like a smallish blade consistent with the size of like a paring knife.
Okay, so we're talking probably 3-4 inch blade.
Yeah, about that. And at the time of like this attack or her murder, when she's 4,000 miles away, it was the same time that Nancy's photo fell from the wall.
Okay, that's bizarre.
Isn't that so creepy?
I don't believe in magic or psychics, or I'm just going to come out and say it. I think it's all a bunch of bull. Except when psychic Monica read our palm. I was like,
we loved Monica. She was great.
Like, you have two hands. I'm like, I do have two hands.
Shut up. She was better than that.
But regardless, what I'm getting at is that I don't believe in coincidence. I'd like that. Yeah. But this is, that's really, really skeevy.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah.
So with such a small time frame, kind of like you just brought up, with such a small time frame from when Jody took a nap to like her finding Nancy, the investigators decided to do a test. So they start running the water in Nancy's bathroom and like making noises while another investigator was in Jody's room. Mm-hmm. And they actually agreed that with the layout of the apartment and the construction of like the apartment, it was very likely that Jody, while she was asleep, would not have heard anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Jody told them about the cutlery salesman and they were super quickly able to like track those guys down and they talked to them and they explained that they had met Nancy earlier in the day while she was out and she agreed to let them come do their pitch because like it would put her name into a raffle for some free prizes. Oh, and like
I get that.
They would get the credit and like there was no obligation for her to actually buy anything.
If this were a crime show, we would have made at least 10 minutes out of these guys. Could it be the knife salesman?
I love how dramatic those shows are.
They are. They're bad.
Well, they actually both were really happy to take polygraphs, cooperated fully, and with no deception indicated by either of them, and they corroborated Jody's timeline, they were off the hook. Like, they were pretty much crossed off the list.
Wow.
So police tracked down everyone that Nancy worked with or, like, had been friendly with. after they talked to everyone, nothing produced like any leads for the investigators.
I feel like there's leads too that would have to be tracked down if like one of my, however many brothers she has, one of my brothers has somebody who tried to date me and now he's just mad at me because I said no. So it's like, I feel like there could
be a perpetrator
in her own inner circle.
Except that she's all the way in Hawaii and a lot of their friends are probably way back in Michigan. Like,
that's true.
Not even Colorado. So, all right.
Theory debunked already.
Well, speaking of Colorado, you know, the Anderson family, they're back there, they're grieving and they're just trying their best to like think of all the conversations they had had with Nancy and see if they could come up with any additional names for the police. They did make the trip back to Michigan to hold a funeral and to lay Nancy to rest next to her dad. So a few weeks after that, the family was back in Colorado and they received a strange call from a man named Mike. So Mike calls to offer his condolences and he says that he's Nancy's boyfriend.
Who nobody knew about.
Exactly. This is incredibly odd for the family because, like you said, no one knew anything about a boyfriend, let alone a boyfriend named Mike.
Yeah.
So he offers to bring Nancy's personal belongings back to the family. So he does. So he visits the family and like they appreciate that he brought her stuff, but they all agree that he's just kind of a weird dude.
I think Mike did it.
Well, you'll see. So the family does like call the police and they're like, hey, do you know about this Mike guy? Because he's kind of a weird dude. And it turns out that they actually did know about him and they had questioned him, but he was ruled out as a suspect because he wasn't even on the island of Honolulu at the time of Nancy's murder.
Oh, I wonder if that was proven or if that was the story they were like, okay.
I don't know, but it's just so weird that this guy kind of came out of nowhere saying he's like the boyfriend. Like, it's just a weird thing. This whole case is filled with wild instances. By June of 1972, pretty much all the tips and leads had been exhausted and the case was kind of put on a shelf with, at that point, they're like, hopefully we'll get a deathbed confession or like someone who knows something will get busted and like snitch on the killer to make a deal. Mm-hmm. Like they didn't have much hope that this was going to be solved. So the Anderson family's left with no answers and yet again having to figure out like how to pick up the pieces of their life and move on. Like, this is two very serious tragedies in a short amount of time.
Well, and one was an accident, so you can kind of come to terms with that, but an unsolved murder of one of your loved ones, that's just without that closure, you know?
Such a brutal one.
Yeah.
So I will say that Thelma found peace with Nancy's death kind of through her own faith, and while the siblings really wanted more answers, they didn't want to push too much because they didn't want to upset Thelma. So 29 years later, when Thelma passed away in 2001, the siblings all felt like, all right, Mom is with Dad and Nancy now, so now she knows what happened, but now we want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And kind of off topic for a second, that's so sad. Like, I hate that she died without knowing who killed her daughter.
I've had family members talk about that before, about how, like, part of the mission to because on Cold Case Files, all the cases were cold for lots and lots of years. So these children sometimes can see the mom and dad. You can hear them, the grief, the pain that they're going through. Then all of a sudden, 30, 40 years pass and their parents are in their 90s and like every month could be their last. They just want something, if not for nothing else, for them so they can see justice.
100%. And I mean, it's great for Thelma if she was able to make peace with it. Like, that's great. But at this point, the siblings are like, we have not made peace with it. We want to know what's happening.
Good for them. I applaud them for that.
This group of siblings is amazing. Like, Nancy had some seriously awesome brothers and sisters.
She was awesome. So that checks.
That's true. They all seem really great. So Nancy's sister wrote to the Honolulu chief of police and she, you know, asked about Nancy's case being reopened. And without any hesitation, this chief of police was like, let's do it.
Like, good for him.
We're going to reopen this case. And actually, at that time, Nancy's case was Hawaii's oldest cold case. And of course, DNA technology had come a long way.
Light years.
Yes. And like I mentioned earlier, the original police in 1972 did an amazing job. They, you know, everything was properly collected and it was all sealed. So the evidence of all those bloody towels, they had that. It was still able to be used, which is wild because I feel like we always hear that, like, oh, the evidence room burned down or it flooded or they put it in a plastic bag and it should have been in a paper bag or whatever, but everything was still in great condition. So in 2003, they tested the bloody towels and they determined that they had a complete unknown male DNA profile.
Super cool.
Yes. So cold case investigators were able to track down like every man that the police in 1972 had spoken to.
Mm-hmm.
And each one of those men happily cooperated and gave DNA samples.
Every single cold case detective that I've ever spoken to, the first step is to re-interview anyone they possibly can. When they open up these case files that are decades mm-hmm. old, who's still alive? Can we get them to corroborate their story? And also, if they're going to go after these guys now with the advent of DNA technology, 99.9% of them, if they're innocent, are going to be like, oh my God, yes, finally. Right?
Let's go.
And if they don't, they're the guys you got to look, take a second look at.
Well, that's, you'll see.
So I still think it's Mike. So clearly.
It's not my poor Mike. So despite the length of time that the DNA testing took and like they're still not getting out any positive matches, the team puts the DNA into CODIS because after all, with such a violent crime, like you have to think that
somebody's in there.
Yeah, that he would have dealt with law enforcement over the years, but no matches.
What year are we in?
We are in 2003 is when they reopened it. So we're 2003, 2004, 2005, somewhere in there.
Databases were still being built up. So there's a chance that it could have been a violent offender and he just hadn't been in the system yet because the parameters were still kind of fuzzy.
That's true. Yeah. Well, unfortunately for Nancy's case, this kind of meant it returned to pending status and didn't go back to being cold, but it was cool.
Yeah.
But at least at this point, they know for sure who didn't do it. So that's a step in the right direction. But the siblings did not give up. Jack and his wife started watching shows like Long Lost Family and all these other things where they would use DNA to find like adoptees. And they had like a light bulb moment. Jack was like, there has to be a way to use that same method to find Nancy's killer.
There is.
There is. It wasn't until January of 2018 that the family reached out to the chief of police to ask about any possibility to use genetic genealogy in Nancy's case. And again, to the Honolulu Police Department, like to the department's credit, they were totally honest with the family. They were like, we know what that is, but we've never used it. And unfortunately, like our forensics are not set up for that.
Yes, the Honolulu police would not be equipped to handle that. And also it's expensive. So whether or not they had the money to have all that done.
This department, again, so much credit to them. Unlike a lot we hear about, they were more than willing to allow the family to look for additional help with the process.
Hmm.
And this is where the wonderful CC Moore enters the chat.
Ah, CC, I'm pseudo friends with CC. I've interviewed her twice now for Cold Case Files. Cece's a badass. So she has solved a lot of cases using genetic genealogy, and she has sort of become the face of genetic genealogy. Like you'll see her on, she had her own show for a while.
Yeah.
And she's really like brought into mainstream this whole technology, and people are so quick to interview her. I had reached out to her about coming on, so we don't have an answer yet, but she said, yeah, I'm interested. And then I haven't heard from her. So maybe we'll have her on if we're lucky, but Cece is one of the premier names in genetic genealogy.
She absolutely is. And actually, she and Colleen have worked on stuff together.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. So Jack decides to take a leap of faith and he reaches out to Cece about Nancy's case. And like, apparently he reached out to her and before the day was even over, Cece responds and she's like, absolutely, let's do this.
Cool.
So she and her team at Parabon, they started the work to like, get this moving. So they started by using the DNA sample to make a digital composites photo of the suspect. Mm-hmm. And this is called snapshot phenotyping.
Yes, and it's freaking awesome. Like they will use genetic markers of a human being and recreate their face just using their genetics. It is awesome.
It is really cool. So almost 50 years after Nancy's death, investigators like now had a new lead with the like this snapshot phenotyping. They kind of had a prediction of what who her killer was. So it was very fair skin, brown or hazel eyes, brown or black hair, with ancestry from Southern Europe and Southeastern Europe. So armed with this information, Cece got to work trying to build out possible family trees and came up with everything leading back to Romania and two different places in Southern Italy.
Crazy.
So now, Cece goes back to the 1971 Honolulu phone book, which thankfully had been digitized by this point. So she starts at the beginning and starts looking for surnames with a Romanian or Italian origin. And she worked on like building out these family trees.
This is what I was talking about last week about how simplistic it is. Like it involves like very limited technology. It's research.
Well, and as we kind of talked about, like this is very time consuming work. So she's going through everything. And when she gets to the C's in that phone book, she comes across the name Tudor Shirilla, like Tudor, like a house, like T-U-D-O-R is his first name.
Shirilla.
Yeah. So Shirilla is a Romanian surname. And our girl starts building this family tree. It was half Italian and half Romanian. And Cece's next step was to use online archives and dig into this guy's past. And she found photos of him as a young man. And it is so ridiculously close to like that snapshot phenotyping composite they came up with.
That's so cool. I love seeing this. If you follow any cold case that has a composite sketch that was done whenever the case happened, 80s, 70s, 90s, whatever, you'll see if it lingers for decades. When people like Parabon come in, they will do an updated sketch. And
yes.
That updated sketch is usually rooted in DNA and phenotypes and all these other things. And when they eventually catch the guy, you'll find they often look a lot like that updated composite sketch.
So they do some digging. And at the time of Nancy's murder, Tudor was living with his wife about 2.5 miles from Nancy's apartment.
Oh, man.
He was working as a teaching assistant after getting his master's of arts from the University of Hawaii. So Tudor ended up leaving Hawaii for the mainland and ended up earning a law degree in California in 1977. And then by 1980, he was practicing law in Nevada.
Wow, smart guy.
Yeah. So he and his wife had 3 children. They had 2 daughters and a son. And Tudor is working as a deputy attorney.
You're going to tell me this guy ends up being a killer?
Just remember, not all perverts wear signs.
This is a prime example. Wow.
Cece keeps digging into Tudor and some sketchy shit comes up, basically. So they find a criminal record for refusing to pay his ex-wife child support to the tune of $30,000. Which, hold on, if we're talking 2025 money, that's like $120,000.
Oh my God, that's insane. That's years of child support.
Like, you're clearly a scumbag if you're not paying for your children.
Yeah, I was going to say pay for your children. Like, it's not about him trying to skirt the system. Like, pay for your kids, dude.
Exactly. He had also been arrested for kidnapping a girlfriend, threatening to kill her, all while forcibly holding her down with scissors because she was trying to break up with him.
How is this guy a lawyer? Don't they have background checks?
I have no idea, but bag of dumpster sludge, he was also connected to the running of Mustang Ranch, which was a brothel owned by like a mobster.
Yeah, I've heard of it. I was like, you said that and it jarred my, it's like, oh, the Mustang Ranch.
You're like, oh, my hangout, what?
Oh, right. It's the Bunny Ranch.
So in November of 2021, Cece presented her research to the Honolulu Police Department, naming Tudor Shirilla as the possible suspect in Nancy's murder. To say the police were skeptical is a little bit of an understatement, but Shirilla's history really helped change everyone's moods, and the case is back to the detectives to see if they can make any type of connection between Nancy and Tudor.
Yes, because now the police are tasked with picking up where that legwork left off, because just because you have a guy that seems to match based on where he lived and his you know what I mean, his genes, you now have to prove that he committed a murder.
Well, no matter how hard they tried, they could not make any connection stick. So now the only thing they can do is like find a way to get Tudor's DNA and compare it to the sample they had from the crime scene.
Yep.
Now, Cece's hunch is a good hunch, but without the police being able to make any connections, they're not going to be able to get a warrant for his DNA. No judge is going to sign off on that.
Right.
So Honolulu PD worked with Reno PD to attempt to collect discarded DNA from Shirilla. But at this point, this guy's like an old man. He lives alone. So they've, you know, Reno helped out and followed him around for a while, but they just don't have an opportunity to get anything.
Okay.
So now police need to get creative. And I think it's pretty fair to say his refusal to pay child support makes him a giant bucket of scum.
Agreed.
And with a little digging, it appears Tudor's son agrees with that analysis, as they have a very strained relationship. So the next best thing Cece and her team could get was the son's DNA.
Familial.
Yep. So Honolulu PD reached out to the Newport Beach, California Police Department for help. And when they go make contact with Shirilla's son and like they ask if he'd be willing to provide a sample, his response was, "This is about my father, isn't it?"
He knows his dad's true colors. Wow.
So John Shirilla, son of Tudor, he provided a DNA sample to police. And in April 2022, it was confirmed that John was the biological son of Nancy Anderson's killer.
Wow, science is so fascinating.
It's so wild. So armed with this information, Honolulu PD was able to get a warrant for Tudor Shirilla's DNA.
This is awesome because there's no way that when this crime was committed that these perpetrators would have any clue that genealogical DNA was going to come knocking at the door decades later to derail. Is they weren't taking the precautions like killers today. If you commit a crime today, you're stupider than any of the criminals back then, because there are so many shows that tell you we're going to catch you. Like anything you do or leave or even look at a crime scene, you're going to be caught. You're going to be caught. So
agreed. You talked about this, I think, last week. Like, I love the thought of these criminals sitting in their house, waking up every morning with a pit in their stomach being like, is today the day?
The second you see Joseph D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, on the front page of the newspaper, start looking over your shoulder.
So on September 6th, 2022, law enforcement shows up at Shirilla's apartment. And when he answered the door, he had like a very strange initial response to them. Like when they asked if they could come in and talk to him, he goes, "If I let you in, do you guys take that like to arrest me because you're inside?" They were like, no, like, we don't have any intent to arrest you right now. Like, that's just
or false. Should we? Yeah,
exactly. So Shirilla lets police in. And after being told why they're there, he tries to resist giving like his DNA. But ultimately, he had to comply.
As a lawyer, he should know that.
Exactly.
If I decline, better bet your ass that they're coming back with a warrant if they don't have one already.
I'm Detective B with the Honolulu Police Department. We're investigating a murder from 1972. Okay, so we have a signed search warrant to obtain a sample of the DNA.
Isn't that illegal?
No, it's not illegal because we have a search warrant and a seizure order.
So they get his DNA and they leave. And over the next 48 hours, Shirilla did some weird-ass things. Like, he transferred his car to his neighbor. And then he attempted to take his own life by overdosing on Tylenol. But during that attempt, he managed to start a fire, which then led to emergency services coming and ending up saving him from overdosing. So,
what an idiot. I love it.
I'm like, you wouldn't want to draw attention to yourself, sir, but sure, start a fire. So on September 14th, 2022, Nancy's family got the phone call they waited half a freaking century for.
Unreal.
Tudor Shirilla was a DNA match and had been arrested for the murder of 19-year-old Nancy Anderson.
That news was as exciting, whether it, obviously they wished it came 50 years earlier, but to get it at any point, It's probably the greatest day of their life.
I imagine you let go of a breath you didn't realize you were holding.
Yeah, and you don't celebrate. It's not because it's not a celebration. It's the closing of this chapter, that this wound that's been open for so long, and it doesn't heal the wound either.
Right.
But now you at least have some answers. But then you got to get ready for the trial, should a trial happen. And that just brings up all that stuff that you'd spent half a century, like you said, forgetting.
So Shirilla's extradited to Hawaii and bail is set at $1 million, meaning Shirilla was going to have to await trial sitting in a jail cell. However, on December 25th, 2023, Tudor Shirilla was transported to the prison infirmary and then to the Queens Medical Center, where he died without ever standing trial or providing any answers as to how he knew Nancy or why he killed her. We have no idea how they knew each other. Like, we have absolutely no idea.
That's just as hard for the family, too, because some people don't care. Some people don't want answers. They don't need to know the hows and the whys. They just know, you took my loved one's life, pay the price. But now it's a double whammy, because not only do you not get to see this guy held accountable for what he did, now you have to deal with the fact that you may not even know anything.
We'll get to the family in a second. But according to an article from Hawaii News Now, quote, this is like about him dying, quote, the autopsy report showed sepsis caused by a urinary tract infection is what killed him. But there were other contributing factors, tongue cancer, diabetes, and a heart condition and kidney stones.
All right.
Right?
Don't you get urinary tract infections from not peeing after sex?
I'm pretty sure no one was having sex with this guy, but yes, I think so. But
wasn't he in jail?
Yes.
I guarantee somebody was having sex with him.
I just love the fact that a UTI took this motherfucker out. Like, that's my favorite thing ever.
Cranberry juice would have saved your life, man.
Ugh.
A little ocean spray.
Well, I'm certainly not happy with the outcome, like, because I feel like justice wasn't served. But agreed. Jack Anderson, number 8, he spoke out saying that it was almost poetic justice for him to die on Christmas Day, because the Christmas holiday was the last time their family ever saw Nancy.
I never even thought about that.
Isn't that wild?
It didn't dawn on me when you...
There's a lot with the dates in the story and the number 2 and just a lot of crazy coincidences. So Jack and the other siblings, they also have found peace and comfort that they kept their promise to their sister. Like, they never gave up. They found her killer, and he died miserable, alone, and with no control.
Good. Perfect. Just like he provided Nancy.
Yeah, and like, I have to agree with them. Like, knowing, like, it sucks that he didn't get held accountable, but knowing that this piece of shit spent the last year of his miserable life in prison being alone and, like, hopefully in excruciating pain, like, that warms my heart.
The perpetrator had to deal with the fact that he was arrested for the crime that he thought he was going to get away with.
Mm-hmm.
So that could have exacerbated all these conditions. Like, he could have, his body, you know how your immune system drops when you're stressed?
Yeah.
Or when you're, like, imagine the weight of that. So,
yep.
Especially being an attorney, you know, like, his reputation
was,
like, done. Everything about him, his legacy, anything good he did in his life is now, this is what he can be remembered for.
Yep. Well, in one final way to honor Nancy, all of her siblings and Cece Moore, they came together to help create an affordable DNA database for law enforcement.
Very cool.
And Jack Anderson has written a book, which actually Sue read and relied on heavily for this case. It's called The Brittle Riddle. And all the proceeds of the book go to DNAjustice.org, which is a nonprofit that helps law enforcement cover expensive DNA testing.
Because they are expensive. I think we'd have to go all the way back to our interview with Bill Lott.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what block. It was at Betty Jones, Catherine Krigler, the investigator that solved that. Remember, he was talking about the fact that a show contacted him and was like, if you're on the show, we'll help fund the testing. So, like, we're talking like $10,000 that a department has to come up with sometimes for these tests. So it's not chump change.
No, it's very expensive. But back to the book for a second. I haven't had the opportunity to read it, but apparently Jack really wove his family's story together in, like, such a beautiful way. So if anyone's looking for a quick read or, like, a short audiobook, it's only about 100 pages or, like, 2-hour audiobook. And Sue really recommends it. So I downloaded it earlier. I haven't had a chance to start it yet.
It's up there with Oprah. If Sue's recommending
it. And now we know the proceeds are like going to a good cause. So
that's really cool.
And just one more thing. If you've used a genealogy service like 23andMe, Ancestry, MyHeritage, etc., you can go to the DNAjustice.org website and upload your information and like hopefully help solve some crimes.
I don't know how I feel about that.
You know what? I didn't know either, but I decided I'm going to do it. I really could kind of care less about like the roots, like finding out your roots and where you're like, I don't really care. But if it could help ID just one person, like even if it's a John or Jane Doe, like even if it could identify, so give someone their freaking name back, like it's so worth it.
But it is. And it's definitely a risk versus reward thing because, for example, 23andMe, I believe, do not quote me on this, don't come at me, people, just went bankrupt. And so all that DNA that was stored in their system, where's that going? I suspect being sold to third parties. But that's just what I'm, that's me just talking.
Well, I don't know. But I mean, I think that if it can solve a crime, you know.
I agree. That's the, if that were almost like a promise or a guarantee, I would, you'd have my DNA tomorrow.
Right. Well, if you've been thinking about it, this is your sign to do it because I'm going to do it. Be cool. So
when I see a Melissa clone turn up in Pontiac, Michigan, because somebody from China sold your DNA.
Terrifying. Could you imagine a clone of me? Oh, I'm pretty annoyed by myself. I can't handle another one.
No.
Well, anyway, that is the super sad case of Nancy Anderson, which went unsolved for 50 years. But crazy. You know what? We can't think of it like that. I feel like we have to think of it like, yeah, it went unsolved for 50 years.
Exactly.
But look what happened.
It's sad to see what happened to her because I do think she would have went on to do great things.
I agree. And you know what? I'm really excited to read the book because I feel like it's going to be like more insight into just her personality. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to that. But
let me know how it is.
Yeah, I will. And if anyone has read the book, let us know what you thought of it. I would love to hear. So you can hit us up on our socials at Murder Unscripted. You can email us at murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com. Or you can actually drop us a line through our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Did you see the new graphic I made?
No.
The contact card?
Oh, I have not seen it, but now I'm excited.
It was in last week's episode, so which just proves to me
you didn't yet.
I know, but it's pretty cool. So,
all right. Well, everyone needs to check that out.
It's true. What do we got next week? I'm going to be telling you the incredibly sad cold case. And this wasn't as long as some of these other ones we've been doing. This only stayed cold. It's under a decade. And digging into the materials that I have, there's some spots I'm scared to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
There's some spots that I'm going to really tread lightly because of the people that are involved. And there's just some really interesting behind the scenes stuff, including something that happened to a crew member of mine that has never happened to me in my career. And it's haunting.
Oh,
get ready for that.
All right. Well, that is coming up next week. So you definitely don't want to miss that. So if we got nothing else, thank you again to all of our listeners, the ones we mentioned and the ones that we didn't. We appreciate you. So until next week, be safe, be kind, and remember, perverts like Chivarella, whatever his name is, don't always wear signs that say they're perverts.
Sometimes they're named after sedans. Two-door Chevrolet.
I would think of the house first.
Like a Tudor.
Yeah.
Well, we agree to disagree.
Bye.